Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Just like when we covered croup, we're going to go over the basics of bronchiolitis. And I thought of it like podcast 1, 2, 3, ABCs, why not? So bronchiolitis is another condition that's going to be common this time of year. So if you're listening to this around the winter months, then you're going to start seeing bronchiolitis. And it's possible that where you're at locally, you may not be seeing it until a little bit later. And in other parts of the country, you're going to be seeing it right now. That's the neat thing about this is it seems to kind of just move through slowly throughout the country, and then it hits hard and it seems to hit for multiple months. So there's a whole spectrum, just like croup. A lot of these kids are going to be mild. But there's some nice literature to help explain some of the key components about how we diagnose this, the concerning findings we need to look for, the treatment, and the overall management of these patients. The two that I'm going to be using mostly to talk about are the NICE and the AAPA guidelines. And I did that for two reasons. One is because those are two really well done guidelines, but also because we have been picking up quite a few new followers. And a lot of those are coming from other countries outside the United States, including the United Kingdom. We're getting a whole bunch of people there. So England, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, Northern Ireland, I should specify. But anyway, United Kingdom, and the rest of the outside world, outside the United States, I want to make sure we are including those types of people in this discussion. So we have the NICE and the AAPA guidelines. Now, the diagnosis of bronchiolitis is clinical in nature. Yes, we have RSV swabs, and we may use those as well, but the true bronchiolitis diagnosis is consistent of things like rhinorrhea, cough, tachypnea, retractions, wheezing, grunting, and nasal flaring. In the very young patients, it may just simply be apnea, which can, of course, be difficult. We get these brew-type patients, the patients where all they come in is just this sudden unexplained event that has resolved on its own. That's why it's called BRU, brief resolved unexplained event. And we see these types of patients, and they're often very young when we see that. But again, we need to consider that when someone comes in with apnea, you know, these very young patients, that we need to at least have it in the back of our mind. So as a reminder, again, basic diagnosis, rhinorrhea, cough, tachypnea, and then the more severe cases, we may see retractions, wheezing, grunting, nasal flaring, all that kind of stuff. But what findings are the ones that we need to find the most concerning? Well, actually, there's a really recent study that discussed this, and the journal feed, which is a great FOMED resource. If you do not read journal feed yet, check it out. Daily updates. I love it because I can catch things like this. And they even developed their own scary mnemonic. And I like this because it's easy. It's an easy one to look up. And it's one that we are going to include in the show notes as well. S is for saturation less than 90%. C is you can't tolerate PO. So they have poor feedings or dehydration. A is for apnea, reported or observed. R is for retractions. And that also includes nasal flaring or grunting. And then Y is for young, those less than 2 months of age. If patients have any of these risk factors, now in the original study, they talk about like point scoring and stuff like that. But really, if any of these kids have any of these risk factors, we need to consider admission. And if nothing else, maybe at least talking to our local pediatrician. The reason why we look at these patients for possible admission is because they're at higher risk of needing escalated care. They're not just going to need the supportive stuff at home, like the suction and saline and things like that. What they may actually need is like the high flow nasal cannula, where sometimes, yes, they may just need a little bit of supplemental oxygen, but that high flow nasal cannula is going to be a lot more intensive. They may even need non-invasive or truly invasive ventilation, up to and including intubation, or just in general ICU admission. All these types of things are things that we need to consider when we see these types of kids. So again, if they have anything scary, see how I use that? If they have anything scary, we need to consider these patients for admission because, again, they have a higher risk of needing escalated care. Let's talk about the treatment in general. First, let's talk about the things you should not routinely at least be doing. Antibiotics, big one, because, again, this is mostly viral. Hypertonic saline, really no benefit with that. Racemic epinephrine, usually not. Albuterol or salbutamol. Ipratropium bromide or Atrovent. Montelukast, systemic or inhaled corticosteroids, and chest physiotherapy. Now, there are exceptions to each one of these, but in general, That's what we want to avoid. We don't want to do these things routinely, and it's pretty well been laid out by NICE and AAPA with the research as a supplement that, again, we need to avoid this most of the time. There are exceptions to any of these, but let's talk about the ones that are routinely recommended. So oxygen administration if the saturations are less than 92%, high-flow nasal cannula for those who aren't improving or are in respiratory distress, even with regular oxygen supplementation. The need for CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure in children with impending respiratory failure. That is one that we need to at least, again, remember that when these kids are bad, they may not be able to get better with high-flow nasal cannula alone. They may need some additional stuff. And then also, we need to give fluids to those that are unable to tolerate PO. I notice in NICE, they go for more nasogastric or orogastric and talk about freely putting tubes down that way. But also, let's consider IV fluids. All right, so just like we talked about with SCARI, then what about the patients that would potentially be appropriate for discharge home? Well, the big things are they improving? So, you know, these kids often come in, again, they may not be that bad, and they don't have any of the scary mnemonic things we worry about. So again, as a reminder, they do not have saturations less than 90%. They can tolerate PO. They haven't had any episodes of apnea. They haven't had any retractions, nasal flaring, or grunting, and they're older than 2 months of age. So all these kind of things that we'd be worried about, less likely to need, you know, escalation in their care. If they're doing that, then hey, they probably can go home. But what should we do about that as well? So we need to consider the circumstances about the discharge. We've all probably done the social admissions before, and that may be something that we need to consider here. So are these kids that are in good places where they can stay, where they're going to be taken care of well? You know, is there going to be anything that's going to exacerbate it, like smoking, for example? What about the caregivers themselves? Do they have the skills, the knowledge, the confidence to manage this? Maybe they simply need some additional help. Maybe they need an observation period in the hospital where the pediatric nurses or whoever's going to help take care of them can kind of, you know, give them a little advice and help support them and make sure things aren't going to get worse. Then what about the distance? So in my area, it's not uncommon for people to have to travel an hour or more to get to the hospital. Well, if I have someone who lives in the same town as the hospital, maybe it's not as big a deal. But if they're living an hour away, maybe they had a borderline story. Maybe they, when they initially came in, their saturations were a little low, or maybe they're a little more tachypnic than we'd like, but they got better, you know. Is that someone who we'd still feel comfortable with going home? Well, that's something we need to talk about pretty well, especially if there's any, you know, again, things that we'd be worried about for deterioration, not necessarily the scary mnemonic, but the things that are going to be, you know, borderline at best. So really we need to look at, are they clinically stable? Can they tolerate PO fluids? And can they maintain saturations over 92%? This is going to be tricky too, because we need to consider 92% or more while they're also sleeping, which can sometimes be hard to see, but a lot of these kids are going to be well appearing enough, and especially in these really young babies and stuff like that, they're probably going to sleep at some point while we're monitoring them. So if there's any concern about that oxygen saturation dipping down, maybe they're like 93, 94% while they're awake, but they're really congested. Maybe we have some concerns, maybe something that parents said at home that maybe they just didn't quite seem as right. Okay, maybe we should watch them until they go to sleep just to see if they are indeed improving. But that's going to be almost a case-by-case basis. So to recap that, are they stable? Which goes back to the whole like scary mnemonic thing and just seeing how they're doing impression-wise overall. Able to take PO fluids and then saturations over 92% on room air. This is pretty similar if you remember from like asthma exacerbation patients. But then we also have to remember our scary mnemonic, which as a reminder is saturations less than 90%. They can't tolerate PO, including just having poor feedings or signs of dehydration. They have reported or observed apnea. They've had retractions, nasal flaring, grunting, or they're less than 2 months of age. Any of those types of things or anything else that has us concerned, we should be considering admission because the potential for the need of escalating care. This is all meant to be a quick reminder because during this busy year, we're going to see lots of these types of patients. And this is something that we should be able to be very familiar with, just like with croup. So although the treatment isn't usually much, it's usually just really supportive care, truly legitimately supportive care, those ones that are going to be on the more extreme side, we need to be prepared with early and be able to recognize them early versus waiting until they get much worse. I'd love your thoughts and feedback. Let me know. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.